This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow producing, and we start the week with Louis Wren, the president of the Louisiana AFL-CIO, largest labor union in the state, an organization that has been politically powerful for generations. Some would say not as much as it used to be, but unions are still a major force in Louisiana. And Louis Wren is at the Capitol every day during the session. And for the last several years, he has been fighting for an increase in minimum wage. Now, the Senate Labor Committee last week did pass on a 3-2 vote an increase, but the House Labor Committee's already shot it down, which probably means it's dead on arrival. In the final days of a session, there can be legislative maneuvering. Things can be tacked on as amendments. Is there any hope, or is it another case in which we're going to stay at 725, Louis Wren?
Well, good morning, Jim. I think there's little hope. I like to picket lobby and say they don't have any members who pay minimum wage, and we don't have any members that make it. But we're going to go every year to the Labor Committee and do what I love to call the Chicken Little Bill. And listen to them talk about how if we pay people a little more money, the sky will fall. The sky will fall.
Well, there's this claim that if you raise minimum wage, everything else goes up, and we have inflation, and we don't need any more of that. Is that really true?
Well, it hadn't been true in Arkansas and Florida and the other 30 states that have a higher minimum wage. I'm amazed that when we look at a state policy and we're going to value work, but we're going to value the workers in Arkansas more than we are in Louisiana. What makes an hour work in Arkansas worth more than an hour work in Louisiana?
$11 an hour in Arkansas, yeah. So do the math. And $7.25 is not anywhere close to $11. I'm going to do the math right now. That's 65.9%. And you can cross the border if you live in one of those towns like Lake Providence. Or you can
go to jail, because the best I know, there are no inmates in the work release making $7.25. I think they all make more than that.
Really?
I know in
one parish.
You make
more in jail than you do working at a McDonald's.
They make more in work release. Well, let's give McDonald's their crew. They're hiring at $12 an hour.
Here. I don't know if they are in Tallulah, though.
Well, I don't know. But I did some figuring. I saw the gas this morning, and after you pay a little tax, you would work 8 to 10 hours to fill up a pickup truck of 20 gallons worth of gas. But then you can't afford the pickup truck, so... could you imagine that you would have to work all day long plus a couple of hours just to get the gas, go back and forth to work?
Well, 52 weeks a year times 40 hours times 725 gets you, I think, 15,000, a little change to go with it.
Well, that's before you pay the tax.
Before you pay the tax.
And you have to pay
the
Social
and people
Security.
Wonder why people opt to go on the public dole, because there isn't that much difference. And if you're going to work 40 hours to basically break even, what motivation is there to work?
Well, it costs the taxpayers of the state, because when you go to work every day and you work your 40 hours, or many times it's single women with children, and they have to work more because they're restricted to 32, so they don't get any benefits. So they may work 50 hours and end up becoming burdens to the state. We have to give rental assistance, and we have to give food stamps, and the rest of the state is supplementing that, what they cost, because employers just don't want to do that. And we have another bill down there that says, oh, let's cut unemployment from 26 weeks to 13 weeks. We're going to make people go to work for that $7.25.
877-217-5757 is your number. And our guest is one Louis Wren, president of the AFL-CIO the last 17 years. He is 25 years short of the reign of one Victor Busey, who did it for 42. Louis could do it, but he'll be cracking 90 years old by the time he gets there. But he is the second longest serving AFL-CIO president. And people say unions are somewhat irrelevant. I don't think that's the case, but not as powerful as they used to be. And one of the reasons is that in the state legislature, you don't have many plumbers or teachers or firefighters, police officers. They're doing other things, but you do have a lot of lawyers. You do have some business owners. You have people like that who generally are not union members. So right. Does that make a difference when you're trying to make your case?
I don't know. The Bar Association may be the biggest union in the state. They're required to pay their union dues or they can't practice their trade. I think we've become more like national politics and more partisan. But if you do everything for business, maybe the workers get a little. You look at this fight over the expenditure cap. It reminds me of Washington and the debt limit. Mm-hmm. Some of those legislators had to take the tough votes when the governor got in and they were $2 billion in the hole. And now that they've got some money, they don't want to spend it. I suspect if they could find a way to give the teachers a pay raise without John Bel Edwards getting credit for it, they'd all run to go vote for it.
Well, let's see what happens with a new governor. Maybe this is a question to ask those running. And you are right about lawyers. They have their union aspect as well, and certainly teachers do. But you came through the working class.
I came from the building trades.
The building trades. And those kinds of people, are there any in the legislature now from the world that you inhabited?
Actually, there are a few. One of them is a former iron worker, as is Doug Welborn, our clerk of court, worked at Riverbend as an iron worker
when he got elected. A long time ago, yeah.
Yep.
But who's the former iron worker in the legislature?
Buddy Mincy Jr.
Yeah, very good. Yep. Aaron in Prairieville. Aaron, you're on with Lewis Wren. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. It was kind of sickening to hear y'all talk about minimum wage stuff, about what incentive people have. I mean, the incentive, first of all, is to do better, is to go work and earn more. Most people aren't earning minimum wage. They work the way up from there. It's not supposed to be a living wage. It's something that kids start with and then work themselves up from there.
All right. That's the old axiom, but according to reports, well over a quarter of the workforce in Louisiana, well over a quarter. In fact, it may even be more than half. They earn fewer than $15 an hour on the average. And minimum wage is something that some people do have to do for 40 hours. And some people, as you know, Lewis Wren, they work multiple jobs. They not only work those 40, then they go work somewhere else.
Yep. We have in East Carroll Parish, 20% of the workers are at around the minimum wage. 6.4% of Louisiana full-time year-long workers less than 15,000. 92,000 workers, the second highest rate in the United States. So no, this is not just kids. Actually, I think there is a training wage, but this is people who. You take a single woman and she's tied to two kids and her husband either left her or for whatever reason. Gee, it would be nice. We'd just let you go back to school and improve your education and work your way up. But, at what point do you value that somebody shows up to work every day and they contribute to the bottom line of the company and they ought to get their little share of the earnings they help produce.
And I concur with Aaron that a job has more value than a paycheck. It has a lot to do with people's identity, no doubt about it. But if you have other responsibilities, the time that is invested in that job, and if you can find a way to get comparable benefits and use the time for other things in your life, most people are going to take the latter rather than the former. Mary in Lafayette. Mary, good morning. You're on with Lewis Wren.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Wren. It's good to hear you on the radio.
Good morning, Mary.
I'm calling because Mr. Wren brought up that you can't even put gas in your truck and you can't even afford the truck. People who are using state funds to get by, doing TANF, food stamps, all that stuff, have three kids, have to take the bus. So the number of hoops that people have to jump through to get social programs is not worth staying home.
Well, yeah, you, when you go to work, you have to factor in other costs too, don't you? Transportation being one. Mm-hmm. What if you have to
have child care?
Child daycare. There are all kinds of costs associated with the marriage.
Even if your children in school, mm-hmm. we have free school, but we pay a lot of fees.
Right. Charlotte in Iberia Parish. Charlotte, let's slide you in before the break. Good morning.
Hello. And hello to your guests. I'm calling because there's a fallacy that people enter the job at a low wage and then are promoted. There aren't enough managerial positions for all those people. They shouldn't be paid. They should be paid a living wage for the work they do.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Thank you.
877-217-5757 is your number. We will return the phone calls with the incomparable Louis Wren, president of the AFL-CIO, after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. A bit more time with Louis Wren, president of the AFL-CIO. He's acknowledged that even though a Senate committee did advance a bill to increase the minimum wage, the fact that the House has killed the same bill means that it's probably dead on arrival unless some unusual maneuver takes place. And with a conservative legislature, that would appear to be unlikely. So Louisiana will stay at $7.25, while neighboring Arkansas is at $11 an hour with certainly a more conservative governor than we have in Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Lewis, you mentioned something. You said 32 hours that workers are restricted to 32 hours. I remember before Obamacare, when a worker could work for the same company, get 40 hours, sometimes even get overtime. Well, why are they restricted to 32 hours again?
Well, some of the companies who offer benefits offer them to employees that are considered full-time. So they tend to work some employees less than the 40 hours just to get out of paying the benefits. I would suggest to you that most of these minimum job wages don't come with benefits. Those are the folks who don't get the health care, don't get a retirement benefit.
Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, good morning. You're on with Louis Wren.
Good morning. I heard the lady bring up the bus system. If someone on minimum wage is dependent upon the Baton Rouge bus system, they may never get there. It's the closest thing to no public transportation whatsoever. I would like Mr. Wren to maybe tell us the conservative, so-called conservative legislature, and it's been brought up that Arkansas is $11 an hour. Well, what makes you conservative that you don't want to pay people for their work?
Well, good morning, Mike. Arkansas had something different in Louisiana that they let the people vote. And so that higher minimum wage in Arkansas was through a referendum. The latest poll I found done by LSU says that 80% of Louisiana residents support a higher minimum wage. I do find it amusing that our elected officials are so vastly different than what their constituents actually support.
They're in favor of a representative government until they're not. And Bill Huey asked what the effective pay for Louisiana is, and the average Louisiana worker, according to what I pulled up, is $44,720 a year. That's average. $44,720 a year is average. So the average pay in Louisiana is $21.50 an hour. Most entry-level workers, the average is $27,534. So that's above minimum wage. And that's why this is an act of obstinance more than anything else. It's basically these people saying, you're not going to tell us what to do.
Well, I find it amazing that during the COVID, with the extra federal benefits,
mm-hmm.
We almost got some people to the average. And I would submit to you that it was the greatest small business incentive program we could have ever figured. How many restaurants and small businesses stayed open because people had the money to participate in the economy?
All right.
Like I said, it helped people make it through, but it also helped a lot of small businesses make it through that tough time.
Steve in Mandeville. Steve, you're on with Lewis Wren. Good morning, sir.
I wanted to reference what Charlotte was talking about just a few minutes ago, and that is that when you start off at $7.25 an hour or so and people think you get these great raises, they don't want to give you the raise. I think it ought to be 20% raise at 6 months and then say another 10% every 6 months until you get to a reasonable wage.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's really morally wrong to ask people to work and be in poverty. Someone who goes to work every day, works 8-10 hours a day, 30, 40, 50 hours a week, and then lives in poverty is just morally wrong. I was tickled to see, and we were in a rush, but even the Catholic bishop's representative showed up in the Senate committee to speak to the morality of not paying people a decent wage.
David in Atlanta, our final caller for Lewis Wren. Hey, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. An experienced worker is a valuable worker because it takes time and money to train people. And I can say this with experience. I was a former AFL-CIO chief union steward, Office of Professional Employees International for the largest steamship company.
All right. What's your question, David?
Well, my question is the so-called boom we had in the economy was when Trump was president. It was mostly due to minimum wage increases across the country. Two-thirds of the states raised the minimum wage, and that was the boost to the economy, not so much the Trump tax cuts.
It did happen, although there were tax cuts as well. And as far as economic growth of the last 14 presidents, Trump was dead last of the last 14 U.S. presidents. So I don't think we really had the resurgence that the former president claims. But as far as teacher pay, that also is in perilous condition. As of right now, you have hopes that teachers will get a pay raise this session?
I am hopeful. It's an election year. I really don't think these folks want to go home and tell the teachers they didn't. They're trying this to explain it away that, oh, we're going to take some money and we're going to pay down the debt, and that's going to allow the parishes to have free money. But we just saw in Livingston Parish, one of the most educated-minded parishes, who gave their money away to build a Bass Pro in the TIF, couldn't pass the tax to give the teachers a raise. You know, at some point, they're going to go where there's more money. We already have parishes competing against each other, but I am hopeful that they'll figure a way to work it out.
Well, thank you, Lewis Wren, and let's bring you back soon. We've got to get an update when the session's over. Appreciate you coming in, and we'll let you get back to the Capitol.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And we're joined now by Tony Opetisano. He was the closest friend for many years with Francis Albert Sinatra, the singer of the 20th century, who died 25 years ago last night in Los Angeles, Caesars Sinai Hospital. Frank Sinatra was 82 years old, and he left a mark on show business that is unparalleled. He lasted well over 7 decades as a performer. He started young, and he was still going almost to the very end, and more than 100 books have been written about the legendary crooner and actor, an Academy Award-winning actor, as a matter of fact. But I don't know of any better than Sinatra and Me, which appeared a few years ago. And Tony Opetisano was with him on the night he died and heard his last words. And good morning to you, sir. It's an honor to visit with you on this day of all days, Tony Opetisano.
Oh, thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure, and I appreciate that you had me on.
Well, tell us about those final hours. Frank Sinatra was a fighter. He fought for his life, as you would expect. You were with him. In fact, his wife, Barbara, showed up just as he expired, and what were his final moments like?
He initially was a bit panicked by what was going on, but eventually just became resigned to you know, it was his exit. And I mean, he was as comfortable as you could possibly be at that point. And Barbara was standing next to me. I was standing next to the hospital bed. And Barbara said to him, you know, sweetheart, try to fight. And he said, he just looked at the two of us and he said, you know, I'm losing. And he just drew his last breath and closed his eyes.
But he was aware until the end. And I'm sure that's the way he would have wanted it.
Absolutely. No, he was completely aware. And then, you know, the doctors were doing the best that they could, but he had two major heart attacks within a period of 2 hours. And
let's hold it there. And we're coming back with the best friend of Frank Sinatra, Tony Appedisano. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. The singer of singers, Frank Sinatra, died 25 years ago last night in Los Angeles, May 14, 1998. Born December 12, 1915, Hoboken, New Jersey. He was 82 years old, the chairman of the board. Old Blue Eyes spanned a career from the 40s to the 90s. And he had a career like no other. He sold well over 200 million records that are still selling. And his best friend was Tony Appedisano, who met him when he was 21 years old. Now, Tony O is a professional musician and singer in his own right. And he was a producer and he managed not only Frank Sinatra in a way, he was a member of Sinatra's team, but he also managed comedian Don Rickles, another close friend of Frank Sinatra. And he was with him the night he died, 25 years ago last night. And you mentioned that he had a couple of heart attacks within a few hours. He was fighting for his life, but he was resigned. It appears that he had his end coming, and his last words were, "I'm losing." But you were telling a poignant tale of there he was. I think you were holding one hand, and his wife was holding the other, and off he went.
Yeah, and you know he loved living life to the fullest. And the last 2.5 years or so, 3 years of his life were not exactly the same, because he walked away from performing, and that's something that, as was the case with Don Rickles, it was something that they both loved doing. It was very fulfilling for them, and he felt that he wasn't quite up to giving his audience the same caliber performance that he had for all of his career, and he said they deserve better. And he said, "I'm not going to give my audience less than what they deserve. They put me where I am. They gave me what I had in life, and I'm not going to shortchange them by giving 95% of the performance that I used to give." And he just quietly walked away, and just he felt that was the right thing to do.
You were 21 when you met him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How was that experience, Tony?
it was a bit shocking. I had become friends with Jilly Rizzo, who owned a nightclub on 52nd Street called Jilly's. And Jilly was pretty much the brother that Frank never had, Frank being an only child, as was the case with Don Rickles as well. And Jilly's older brother ran the club in Jilly's absence when he was on the road with Frank. And we hit it off. I went into the club, and I was always in a tuxedo, and he asked me, "So what do you do?" So I said, "Well, I'm a performer. I'm a singer and a jazz musician." And he heard me play and said, "I got to introduce you to my brother." And then Jilly and I hit it off. And Jilly said, "You know, I think you and the old man would be a good fit," which I was blown away by that, because Jilly was very protective of who he brought around Frank. And one night, about 6 months after he said that, Frank was in New York. He was in the middle of his self-imposed retirement at that point in the early 70s. And he had me play. He closed the club at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he had everyone leave, and we were there till about 7 or 7.30. And Frank enjoyed what I did, and we did become very good friends very quickly. And it turns out that the reason he walked away from the business was not only that he wanted to spend more time with his family and friends, but he told me in later years that he wasn't quite convinced that he had something to offer to my generation. And between boatloads of letters that came asking him to at least go in and do an album, and the fact that I was bringing a lot of young performers, singers, and musicians to be in his company, and they were hanging on his every word, he said, well, maybe I still do have something to offer to your generation. And he came out of retirement. I met him in December of 72, and in July of 73, he recorded Old Blue Eyes Is Back, and that fall, he was back out on the road working.
He had that great performance at Madison Square Garden, I remember.
Yeah, live Madison Square Garden. Yeah, with Howard Cosell introducing him as though he were a boxer with the Woody Herman band, and it was a terrific performance, really.
Well, at the end of the 20th century, the BBC ranked the greatest singers of all time, and they ranked Mr. Sinatra number one, Elvis Presley number two, by the way. But there were some others in the top 10, including Aretha Franklin and Barbra Streisand, Bing Crosby, some great voices. But his voice was magnificent, but it was the way he used that voice. Was that something that was self-taught?
He had a very unique style, and it was something that he came up with on his own. He really enjoyed the way people like Yasha Heifetz played unbroken, and playing even though you're bowing the violin, you can't quite hear when the bow stops going in one direction and starts going in the other. And he used to say that you're never quite sure what you're about to say until a split second before it comes out of your mouth, but yet you never run out of air until you've completed your thought, like just now. And he said, so then why, if you are aware of what you're going to say ahead of time by reading a lyric, why would you run out of air before you complete your thought? And he developed that style of singing, which a lot of other performers tried to mimic. And it was very unique. And it's part of what set him apart, that his breathing and his diction and his phrasing. And he always used to, he said he used to choose material to record, not only because of the melody, but he said, I used to look at the lyric and look at it as though it were a movie script. And if it was something that I could touch upon things that happened in my own life and lend more depth to the lyric, that's how he chose the songs that he decided to record.
The guest is Tony Opetisano, who was with Frank Sinatra 25 years ago. It was at this time, quarter century ago, that we were hearing for the first time that Frank Sinatra had died at 82. The book from Tony is Sinatra and Me in the Wee Small Hours, and I would encourage you, if you want to read a biography about somebody who actually knew him, this is the one, Sinatra and Me, from Tony O. And Sinatra, he knew all about singing and using the voice and the breathing, and he was a big opera buff. We know that, but he did things that were not conducive to longevity for the voice. He smoked, he drank, he kept unusual hours. But even when his powers were diminishing, he was still Frank Sinatra. He commanded a stage like few, if any other performers. How did he do that?
He was a very personable guy, and when he went out onto the stage, he would find people in the audience, certain people that he would make a connection with, and he would sing to that person. And similar to what Rickles was doing with comedy. You know, they had a unique capability where they would be able to read their audience. And when he was on stage, everyone in the audience felt like they were the only person he was singing to. It was quite the unique thing to behold from the wings.
He was known, Tony, as a mercurial personality, ups and downs. Was that an accurate depiction of him?
To an extent. I mean, he basically would give people back what they gave him. He was very jovial. He loved living life. But, you know, for example, if he and I were sitting having a conversation and someone would walk over and shove a piece of paper under his face and say, "Would you please sign this?" Like you or I would do, forget that it was Frank Sinatra, you'd look up and say, "Excuse me, can't you see I'm having a conversation with my friend?" However, if a waiter would come over to the table and say, "Those folks over there are big fans of yours, and they were hoping that maybe you could go over and say hello," invariably he would send them around the drinks and then would go over and not only sit down and talk with them, take pictures, he would do whatever he thought would please them. So,
Well, we're going to spend a few more minutes with the remarkable Tony Opetisano, the closest friend of Frank Sinatra. His book is Sinatra and Me. But as we go to the break, Robin Dow, our producer, was born 3 months after Frank Sinatra died in 1998. And she has chosen perhaps his signature song. Let's go to My Way as we hit the break with Tony O.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're finishing up with Tony Opetisano, the closest friend of Frank Sinatra. And when you hear his voice, he sounds a great deal like Frank Sinatra, and as did Frank Sinatra Jr. And Tony O may have been the closest thing to Sinatra's other son. He was with him when he died and was with him those last few years of his life when he was declining. And he died 25 years ago last night, May 14th, 1998. Caesars Sinai Hospital, Los Angeles, California, buried in Desert Memorial Park. Tony, how were those last few years? What did he think about and talk about mostly in the final days and months of his life?
You know, he tried to enjoy as best he could his friends and his family and his fans, as a matter of fact. I mean, he said, you know, you only go around one time, he says, but if you do it right, once is enough, you know. And he did thoroughly enjoy living life, and he made sure that the people in his life that he cared about knew exactly how he felt about them. And he used to joke and say, within your means, you should live each day as though it were your last, and one day you'll be right. He used to joke about that.
Mm-hmm. But, what was it? May you live to be 100, and the last voice you hear be mine.
You hear is mine. That's right. Yeah.
That wouldn't be a bad way to go. Not at
Hell
all.
Hell no.
Now, a listener asks, who was the love of his life? Did he have one who stayed with him until the very end?
You know, if I had to put money on it, not to say that his other wives didn't mean, obviously, a lot to him, otherwise he would not have married them. But for my, in my opinion, I think that the woman that was in his life the most, no matter what he was going through, was Nancy Senior, his first wife, the mother of his children. Mm-hmm. And she was there for him, and even in later years, they stayed in touch. I tried my best to keep that communication solid. And he loved Barbara, obviously. He loved Ava. He loved Mia. But Nancy was. He said, "If you're not building a relationship based on a friendship, then you're building a mansion on a foundation of sand." And he was. I think she was the best friend he ever had. She was there for him constantly. When he needed advice about something, he would get on the phone and call her. And she adored him as well, right up to the very end.
She never remarried. Obviously was in love with Frank Sinatra. And they were married 12 years, and he left her for Ava Gardner. And as we, one last note, you, I'm sure, heard about those years in the 50s in which Sinatra lost it all, lost his wife, he lost his voice, but he came back with From Here to Eternity in 1953. Mm-hmm. How close was he to being a has-been?
It was a pretty tough period, the way he described it. He said, you know, here I am walking through Times Square, and some people were looking at me thinking, was that Frank Sinatra? Meanwhile, a few years earlier, he was stopping traffic. There were people waiting around the block to see him at the Paramount Theater. And it was pretty austere, those couple of years. And that's why when he got back into the business by way of From Here to Eternity, he never looked back. He really enjoyed what he did, and he enjoyed the public. And he gave them the best that he knew how to give.
And he went on for another 45 years after From Here to Eternity. He did it like nobody else, Francis Albert Sinatra. And for most of those years, Tonio Pettisano was with him. And a listener also asked about you and Rickles. And Sinatra and Rickles, of course, were a team. And I know Don Rickles, he had some fun with your name, didn't he?
Yeah, when we first met, I was under contract at Harris in Lake Tahoe, as he was, and I was working in a smaller theater called the State Line Cabaret, and it was right near the South Showroom, the main showroom. And on my night off, I went in to see him, and as he would do in concerts all the way through till the end, towards the end of the show, he would introduce different people to the audience, and he was given my name by the entertainment director, Bob McClure. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, we have a young performer in the audience, and he's doing really well. He's here at Harris in the State Line Cabaret. I would like you to give a very warm welcome to Tony. And he's looking down at the paper. Tony, hop in the sauna. He says, how the hell do you pronounce his name?
Yeah, and there's that legendary story about how Sinatra walked into a Rickles performance.
Oh, yeah.
And what was the first thing Don Rickles said to him?
Well, he was absolutely freaked out that Frank walked into this little place called Murray Franklin's, where he was working. It only seated like 100 people. And all of a sudden, Jilly walked in with Frank, and he, oh, my God, ladies and gentlemen, look who came into the room, and they turned around. And he said, look at that, it's Frank Sinatra. Frank, be yourself. Stand up and hit somebody. and he said, thank God Frank laughed, otherwise they would have found me on a hook in New Jersey.
Well, thank you for joining us today on this of all days. 25 years ago, we lost Frank Sinatra. Tony Opetisano was there, and the book that he wrote about his time with the chairman of the board, Sinatra and Me, is a must-read for anybody who treasured the life and times of the singer of the 20th century, Frank Sinatra. Thank you, Tony. Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored, and it's a pleasure talking with you.
Likewise. And we're joined in our remaining time by one of the most accomplished novelists in the world, Rudis Epetys, who's been with us more than a few times. The internationally acclaimed number one New York Times bestselling author of I Must Betray You and other historical fiction published in over 60 countries and 40 languages. But she is back with a story about writing. Life is a story in motion. Each day you add to your story, revise it, and view it from a different angle. A day is a story, a year is a story, a life is a story, and you are a story. And the book is You, the Story, A Writer's Guide to Craft Through Memories. And good morning to you, Rudis Epetys.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, tell us about how the process, and that's basically what this is about, is so much different, even for accomplished writers, when you're reflecting on your own life as opposed to writing about others' lives.
Yeah, it is quite different. And I'm often asked, you know, when I'm writing my novels, how is it that you do what you do? And I decided, you know, everyone has a story within them. And so I wrote a book that's an accessible introduction to the process to help others not only recognize story components in their life, but write about them. And I have to say, it was a vulnerable experience. I share some of my own experiences in the book to sort of give examples. And that was the first time I had ever done that. It's not fiction.
But you write about how to prepare a novel as well. And as you note, the first draft is almost never the last draft.
Oh, exactly. And I wish people understood that writing is rewriting. If any of your listeners are performers or competitors, imagine if you could go back to your speech or your performance and change something. It could take a mediocre game and make it a winning game. And as writers, we get to do that. We can go back and revise.
And you also take note of the voice. The voice, as you write, is the tangible personality of your writing. It's the unique style and tone that will identify and differentiate you from others. And, of course, a writing voice is different than a speaking voice. But nonetheless, when you're composing, can you hear what you're writing?
I can. And now when I'm writing fiction, I can also hear the personality of the individual characters coming through. And when we're writing about our own life story, it's the same. And, you know, voice, think of voice as if, like you say, like a personality, an identifier. I think if Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, he has a certain voice. We would recognize a Frank Lloyd Wright house. We would recognize a Van Gogh painting. It's a very specific stylistic identity. And in the book, I break down the components of voice and how, you know, people who want to express their own life story, write about their own events, how they can find their own voice.
You have something called the emotion of memory. Writing is a cathartic experience, isn't it?
Boy, it is. And when we open the door to memory, what I found is that more doors were opening and then windows. And these memories came flooding back to me. And I give prompts in the book to help readers reflect upon their own life and perhaps open some of those doors, and also encourage them now to look at those memories and the emotion of memory from a different altitude. You know, when we're experiencing something, it's like we're looking through a first floor window. But with time, we can reflect upon our life as if we're standing on the roof and really see a 360 view. And I think that provides new ideas for story.
Well, this is an important book for anybody who writes, and Ruta is an accomplished writer, and that is an understatement. She knows the terrain as well as anybody, and her book is You, the Story, A Writer's Guide to Craft Through Memory. And we thank you today, Ruta. Congrats again.
Thank you so much.
Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Stay safe and stay tuned.